Hello and good evening, everyone, and welcome to our book club. Now, we are here tonight live on Odyssey, DLive, and on RadioAlbion.com, and we are reviewing Trevor Lynch's Classics of Right-Wing Cinema. Now, if you didn't know, Trevor Lynch is a pen name for Greg Johnson. That's why Greg Johnson is here with us tonight. He doesn't mind us telling you that either. I checked with him beforehand. Didn't want to sort of ruin something that people didn't know, but everyone does know it's quite an open pen name, so I'm not doxing anybody. But that's why Greg's here tonight, and I'll be introducing him shortly. Now, before we do that, I want to say, if you'd like to donate to the stream, if you'd like to contribute to my work, if you want to send a super chat, you can do so via Entropy, or you can do it via Odyssey. We'll read out all paid super chats in the second hour of the show. You can also donate to me via cryptocurrency, and you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So let's get straight into things, and we'll start by going round the group. We'll start with Natty and Bill. Bill's a newcomer. Aunt Sally isn't here tonight. She's a bit under the weather, but I'll throw it over to you first, Natty. How are you doing? Did you have a good weekend? And what did you make of this book?
Yeah, hi guys. Good to see you. I've got a bit of a sore throat, so if I sound a bit off tonight, then you understand why, or if I'm coughing or spluttering or sneezing or whatever it is. So apologies in advance for that. Yeah, brilliant weekend. I really enjoyed this book, and I didn't realize it was until we came to do the missed review last month that it was actually Greg writing it. I was thinking, oh, who's this Trevor Lynch? I'm really keen to meet him and talk to him, because the book is really, really relatable. And there is a particular review in here that I know, given the pre-chat we just had, that we're all pretty much in lockstep on. It's fantastic. They're short. I know you're a big fan of what you might call the toilet book, Mark. Seems how we've done this a few times now, where having a book like this, you can pick it up and read it in short chunks and get all it's very much written from the position of in the trenches where we are at the moment. So it's very, very relatable, and it's a fantastic book. And some of the films on there that I hadn't seen, I actually watched due to the reviews in here. So yeah, highly recommended already. I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Okay, now over to our newcomer, Bill Atherling. Bill, how are you doing tonight? Hope you had a good weekend. What did you think of the book, and what were your initial impressions?
Well, good evening, everybody. How's that sound now, Mark? Can you hear me clearly?
I can now.
Yeah, I had a fiddle. Right, well, first of all, thank you very much for allowing me to come on, and I'm very pleased to be here. I devoured this book. I thought it was an eminently readable piece of criticism. It was written in an engaging, thought-provoking style. There's plenty of critical assessment in there, but there's also humour, and it's absolutely accessible. I found myself not only nodding and agreeing as I read, but I was also smiling and once or twice laughing out loud. It was that kind of text. And I think that the style of writing is that rare thing that's so rarely achieved by academic writers, that both seriously considers the subject matter, has an intellectual gravitas, and relates the findings in a conversational and really easy reading manner. So I really enjoyed it.
Okay, and before I throw it over to Greg, I'm going to give my initial impressions of the book. Now, I really like, as Natty already said, Natty's already ruined my introduction. I really like books that you can digest over a period of time. Now, this is a book I didn't read all of, actually. I'm admitting it now. I only read the reviews of the films I'd seen, and that was because I didn't really see the point of reading film reviews of films that I hadn't seen. Now, if I do see any of the films in this book, I would certainly go and read the reviews, because I found Greg's reviews pretty much, other than one tiny little nitpick throughout the entire book, I found everything that Greg said to be absolutely 100% spot on. He seems to feel exactly the same way about films as I do, which is great. And I found them very, very relatable. I found them easy to read. And I found the films that Greg covered in this book to be really, really good films to discuss. Now, these are classics of right-wing cinema, but they're not all the same films. They're not all action films. You know, they're not all thrillers. There's a range of different films here from different genres, but films that mean something in some way to this movement. And I've got to say, it was a really, really refreshing read. And it was a book that I highly enjoyed. I found it very easy to read. I found it very engaging. I find Greg's writing style, as you'll know from previous previous book clubs, although this is a book club about a book about films. That's probably where I'm getting mixed up. But I found Greg's to be very, very engaging style of writing. And always very, very easy to read. And that's something that I really enjoy, because when I read a book, even if it is an intellectual work, I don't want to read a book that is heavy going or hard going or something that's difficult or isn't really enjoyable. And this book is extremely enjoyable. It's extremely easy to read. And it's a book that you can pick up, put down and come back to, because it's written in that style. Now, in the past, I have said that is kind of one of my favorite sort of styles of writing. And this really bears out in this case. And I'd recommend this to anyone who's into films, because Greg's analysis is not only deep in terms of filmmaking, but it's also deep in terms of the political slant of the film. And obviously, with Greg being a nationalist, it makes for really, really interesting reading. So if you're a film fan and you're a nationalist, you know, my take already is get this book. Now let's throw it over to Greg. How are you doing this evening, Greg? I hope you're well. What made you think about writing this book? And I didn't know you were a big film fan until I read this. I didn't know you were such a big film fan.
Well, Mark, first of all, thank you for having me on the show again. I really appreciate it. I want to thank the other panelists as well. The reason I started writing about film is that film is very influential in our society. I think it is potentially the greatest art form of all. It's the most impactful art form around currently. And you can complain that people don't watch, you know, Shakespeare on the stage and read classic literature and stuff like that. You can say, oh, we're all culturally illiterate. Yes, you can bemoan all these things. People on the right do this all the time. And I do too. I sort of got that out of my system a long time ago. And I started thinking, okay, how do we communicate with people given that we are in this particular kind of culture where film and television are omnipresent, where people increasingly don't read books and so forth? Well, you write about the stuff that they know. More people think in terms of Harry Potter and Star Wars now, then think in terms of metaphors and images and stories from the Bible, you know, the King James Bible, you know, or Shakespeare, for instance. That's just the reality that we live in. 100 years ago, half the, if you want to put it cliches in the English language came from the Bible or from Shakespeare. Now, a lot of the cliches and sort of limping poor excuses for thought that come out of people's mouths come from Star Wars and Harry Potter. Well, I want to communicate to these people. And the reason why I want to communicate with these people is that they're the people we need to persuade. And I also find that there are genuinely valuable things in a lot of films. There's work that I think is genuinely great. And even stuff that's extremely bad and propagandistic is very useful to us. For instance, if people are trained to see the propaganda in film and television, then the propaganda no longer reinforces the message of the establishment. Instead, it reinforces our message. Because whenever they see these propaganda tropes recurring again and again, it drives home that we live in a society with a hostile elite that is bombarding us 24/7 with anti-white propaganda. So it's a very fancy kind of jujitsu move to take the billions and billions of dollars that are spent on mass media, the enormous amount of capital, the enormous amount of talent, human capital that the enemy has on their side in creating this 24/7 propaganda matrix. We can actually turn that against itself just by teaching people to see through the propaganda. And so I thought it was a very useful way that me, just one guy writing on the internet, could go up against these media behemoths. Now, this particular volume is the fifth volume of film reviews that I've done. I started doing film reviews in the year 2000. The first thing that I reviewed was Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film. And then I reviewed the first Lord of the Rings movie, The Fellowship of the Ring. And that was in the fall of 2000. And at the time, that appeared at Vanguard News Network, which was what we would call an extreme Wignat site today. But that review got bounced around so much and resonated so much with people that it got read out on a talk radio show in the Atlanta metro area and discussed. I forget the name of the person who actually did this. I never heard the broadcast. And it was also discussed in an article about Tolkien and the reaction to Tolkien in the Washington Times. So I thought, wow, this is impact. This was the second attempt that I had made at writing about film. And so I just kept going at it. And I've been doing it for more than 22 years now, going on 23. It'll be 23 years this fall since I started doing that. And this is the fifth volume. So I published about 1,000 pages of film reviews now.
Fantastic. Just another point along that similar vein, Greg, is that I think it's quite important to be able to enjoy what otherwise is kind of, you might loosely term as enemy propaganda. I don't think there's anyone who's watching this who wouldn't get fed up in the adverts or in BBC or ITV TV shows. We are in the UK, of course, of having like endless reams of diversity, of historical revisionism, of the diversity type shoved down our throats. And I think being able to have the tool set, like you said, to look past that and pick out parts of a story or parts of a production that actually are enjoyable and do resonate because you've got the knowledge to understand what's being shown to you is really important. And it means you don't just have to despair at the endless trash that's piled up in front of you.
Yeah, you can actually make something out of it. You can use it as a way. Well, first of all, you can enjoy some of it. And second, you can use it as a way of communicating with people and red pilling them about our message. And I think that's both pleasurable and effective as a form of propaganda.
I agree. And I sometimes think when you're a nationalist, you do get these people who are very, very sort of black pilling people to be around, who are very, very negative about everything. And if you enjoy something like films, computer games, comics, anything that sort of normal people may enjoy, you tend to find that there will be somebody in the nationalist sphere who will immediately, and I mean immediately, sort of call you out for that and make out that you're sort of a terrible person for enjoying that, for you know, engaging in something that's sort of a little lighthearted fun, or it's something that isn't direct nationalist literature or nationalist media output. And I do enjoy films, and I do enjoy a good film, but I also enjoy going through films and actually, like you said, seeing if I can spot the propaganda, see if I can see the message that the filmmaker has tried to weave into that. And there's nothing like going to see a film with friends and afterwards, you know, going for a coffee or, you know, sitting down and actually discussing what the film was about, what you got from that particular film. And I think that's very, very important. And I do believe that having nationalist takes on films and on modern media, whether that be films, books, comics, games, whatever, is very important. And I also think it's a gateway to the public. And I used to remember when I was on YouTube, I would produce videos on YouTube of film reviews. And those film reviews were often some of my most viewed videos because normal people came to hear a review that wasn't from the mainstream. And I think it's important not only to do it for nationalists, but it's also important because, like you said, it breaks through to the mainstream. Bill, do you have any thoughts on this before we get into what the main things I want to speak about?
Yes. I'd just like to ask Mr. Johnson, Greg, if I may, about the choice of the films, because that was, for me, very interesting. This is a very broad range of films of different over different eras. Could you explain the choices to the audience, perhaps? Because you do talk about this a little bit in the preface and how it occurred.
Well, I call it classics of right-wing cinema because there's a series of articles, of reviews that I did for the UNS review that I called the classics of right-wing cinema. And pretty much that entire series is in this book. And then there are a few other pieces in there as well that still are of broad interest to right-wingers. And by calling it right-wing cinema, I'm not saying that the filmmaker or the conscious message was right-wing. I just want to argue that it's of interest to people on the right. People on the right resonate with it. People on the right can learn from it and so forth. And we can use this as a way of reinforcing our message in cultural conversations. And so beyond that, my criterion of choice was pretty wide. I asked friends, you as a right winger, what are some of your favorite movies? And so some of them pointed me towards, say, reviewing Conan the Barbarian, or what's a couple of the others that I got suggestions for? Let me just scroll through this. A Clockwork Orange. People suggested I review A Clockwork Orange.
Driver always comes up.
Yeah, Taxi Driver. Yeah, exactly. One person suggested Dirty Harry, but I was already on that. And another person suggested American History X, which I did. So yeah, I polled my friends for things. And then there are a few that are in here that are just films that I saw in the past couple of years in the theaters. There weren't a lot of films out in theaters because of COVID. I did see House of Gucci, which I reviewed briefly. I did see the new Bond movie. I did see Tenet, the very disappointing film by Christopher Nolan, the only disappointing film by Christopher Nolan that I can think of. What else did I see? I saw the new Dune. And so those were thrown in there just because I saw them at the time I was writing these essays. Most of these were written at the same time, or within the same period of time, within a little more than a year. And as soon as I had enough for a book, I just assembled them together and did an index and got a cover and fired it out there. And now I'm working on volume 6. I stopped working on film reviews for the UNS review at the end of 2021. And I've only done a couple of reviews since then. So it's going to be a while before volume 6 appears. But I'm going to be doing more regular reviews this year, actually, just at Countercurrents.
Before we get into the...
I think we've lost Natty there. Natty,
yeah, are you there? I'm not hearing him.
He's just muted up. Huh. I don't know what's happened there.
Oh, sorry, sorry. I had myself on mute there, guys. Yeah, I was going to say, before we get into the films that are in the book, you did briefly mention Harry Potter and Star Wars as being cultural touchstones. And there's a channel on YouTube, woefully underviewed, that I think Mark recommended a couple of months ago, called Guardians of Aria, who's done a series of Harry Potter viewed from the right. But have you ever considered doing that, or do you just think that's ground that's just too well trodden?
Well, honestly, I never really got into Harry Potter. I'm too old for Harry Potter, basically. I was well into adulthood and practically into cynical middle age before the first Harry Potter book came out. I did read the first Harry Potter book, and I guess I read it in 2000. I guess I wasn't quite that old and cynical now that I think about it. But anyway, I was just too old for it, and it didn't capture my imagination, and so I never read any further into the series. I did watch the first movie, and I thought it was fairly well done, but I didn't continue the series either. And I haven't written any reviews of any of the Harry Potter movies. We've had a review of one of the new Harry Potter series at Countercurrents. I did watch one of those, and I just didn't feel like I was missing a lot. So I'm not going to really delve into that, but I don't dismiss Harry Potter. I actually understand that there are serious themes in it and that it really strikes a lot of chords with people. And I had a friend who's now deceased. He died in the fall of 2019. He was a figure in our movement known as Raven Gatto. Really one of the craziest people I've ever known. And he would go off and go paranoid and become your enemy. And then 6 months later, he'd try and be friends again. He was a really trying person, but he was a brilliant person. And I wish I was recording the phone conversation we had where he laid out his entire interpretation of the Harry Potter books, because obviously he really had spent a lot of time reading them and thinking about them. And I thought it was quite compelling. So it is something I'd like to revisit, but I have to say that, you know, my first exposure to it with the first book in the series and the first movie in the series, neither one of them struck home enough to make me really want to go any deeper. But I'm glad that there are other people doing it. I really wish I tried to get Raven to write his ideas about Harry Potter down, but he wasn't one for writing, sadly. So a lot of those ideas are lost. I'm sure if I read the whole series as carefully as he did, some of them might come back to consciousness. I might recall some of these things. But I don't dismiss it as literature, although it's tempting to dismiss it as literature because so many libtards really need to read another book besides Harry Potter. And I find that very trying.
It's just brought up, you know, whenever anything happens. And I think even in a tweet recently where someone was saying that NATO is Harry Potter and Rey Skywalker and all of this going up, Ukraine is going up against Russia, and it's all of these Harry Potter references and Star Wars references. I think one of the reason I bring it up is because I think one of the recurring themes I got from the book and from your reviews is the undertone that a lot of these productions and the people writing them are actively trying to subvert some of the very old and traditional ideas, but they need to cleave to them in order to appeal to audiences. And I think that's really apparent in Harry Potter, which has these kind of religious undertones and the hero's journey undertones and all these other things that are vastly popular because they're legendary. They go back in time and they speak to us on like a metaphysical level, but they also have to try and insert all the stuff we hate, the diversity and the subversion and everything else.
Right.
It seems clear that a lot of the films that we enjoy and films that we can pick out stuff that's themed geared towards our understanding of the way the world is treads mm-hmm. these lines as well, and has to tread these lines to be popular. Otherwise it bombs, it flops, it's not popular. It doesn't hold any lasting value.
Well, the Harry Potter book and movie that I do know immediately appealed to me, although it was kind of kid stuff, because, well, I like Tolkien. I'm an Anglophile. There's so much of the literature that I love is English. So much of the films that I love are English films. And so immediately as an Anglophile, it appealed to me. And what is it showing? Well, it's showing an English boarding school with all of its rituals and things like that. It's hearkening back to traditions. It's hearkening back to distinctly English identity. It talks about magic, which I think is subversive in the modern context because modernity tries to rid the world of magic and mystery. So there are many things about it that are objectively reactionary and also Anglophilic, Anglo-identitarian, and so forth. And then the author obviously has a kind of simplistic liberal message about tolerance and inclusion. But even the tolerance and inclusion stuff, it resonates with things that are deep in English history. The conflict between the Anglo-Saxons and the Normans is alluded to in the story. So I think that it draws upon a lot of things that are of genuine worth, and then because the author is I hate to use this, it's so patronizing, because she's a child of her times and hasn't bothered to think outside her times, she spins it with some really kind of cringe-inducing liberal moralism.
Although she did make the greedy, disgusting bankers tiny little goblins. Who,
yeah, I did find that interesting too. Yeah,
I haven't seen any of the Harry Potter films or read the book, so I've got to own up to being sort of slightly lost throughout this. But let's each of us, and I'll go last here. Go round and pick one of the reviews to discuss with Greg. Which was your favourite review in the book, Natty?
So as soon as I got the book, I was with my girlfriend, and I looked down the list of contents and I saw The Incredibles on there. And I'm not really a fan of animation or the Disney Pixar stuff, but I had seen The Incredibles just by stroke of luck. And I also really enjoyed it. The time I saw it, I couldn't understand why I enjoyed it so much more than a lot of the other stuff that was in that similar vein, if that makes sense. So I read through the review, and I'd forgotten a lot of the film. So we immediately sat down that same evening and watched it again. And I realized there's a reason why it's so enjoyable. And Greg's review were kind of unlocking parts of my brain. I was like, okay, yeah, now I know why. Now I understand why this is good and why it resonates and why the themes in this film touch on things that I think are probably important to all of us here as nationalists.
Greg, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm flattered that you like that. I thought Incredibles was, well, incredible. I thought Incredibles 2 wasn't incredible 2, sadly. But I loved it because it was very stylish. The music was great, sort of 60s spy and sci-fi caper music. But the message was somewhat conservative and somewhat anti-egalitarian. So you have a very much a heteronormative family. You have a message where, and this is one of the things that was kind of strange about it. The Incredibles backstory is that all these people were superheroes, but then superheroes are outlawed as vigilantes. Now, vigilantism is one of the themes that runs through this book. Many of the films in it deal with vigilantism. And vigilantism, of course, is an implicit repudiation of liberalism, because liberalism wants to make everything by the books, and everything's going to be fair, everything's going to be legal, everything's going to be bureaucratic and administered, so we have justice, et cetera, et cetera. And vigilantes point out, but wait a second here, just having this justice-producing machine isn't enough, because there are circumstances where you have to go outside the law to achieve justice. And so that is where superheroes come in, and that is where vigilantes come in. And it's an implicit repudiation of liberalism as this idea that we can have rule by law and bureaucracy that's completely impersonal. So anyway, that's a subversive theme here. Superheroes are vigilantes, and liberalism has outlawed them. Of course, these are people who are serving the public good, but they go outside the law. They're also extraordinary people who are now being forced to pretend to be ordinary. And so it's an anti-egalitarian message as well. And in the end, they come back, right? The family unites together, and they use their superior powers to defeat another kind of superhero, who is actually, or a supervillain. He's a fake superhero, this guy who calls himself Syndrome. And what he is a basically he's an ordinary guy. He's just a giant narcissist who has a lot of money, and he's trying to turn himself into a fake hero using technology. And so it also brings in how technology is sort of leveling as well. So I thought it was a wonderful film and very, very effectively done and just thoroughly entertaining. So yeah, I'm glad you liked it. I did think it really does resonate with people on the right. Another thing that's very important, a lot of people think this is sort of Ayn Randian. And there's this little character named Edna Mode who lives in this modernist house with like Greek statues in it. And she's got, a bob cut hair, black hair, and just this little figure. And people thought she was Ayn Rand. She's really based on a different Jewish figure, Edith Head, the fashion designer. People just looking at the resemblance thought, oh, this is Ayn Randian. It's anti-egalitarian, right? But one of the things that's very un-Randian about this is the fact that the mother tells her daughter, it's in your blood. your heroism is in your blood, which is something that Rand would completely dismiss. Rand didn't believe in heredity, basically. She believed that people could create themselves. Of course, that's a horrible modernist trope. It's the blank slate trope. Whereas in this movie, ultimately, family and blood and heredity are the sources of human distinction. It's not just willpower, the way that Rand would try and make it.
Yeah, there was a couple of interesting points as well. The fact that the main character, I can't remember his name now, Mr. Incredible himself, has to actually go to Edna Mode to kind of unlock his potential after he's been brought low by the bureaucracy. I wasn't sure how to kind of take that, because obviously she does come across as very, just Jewish in her mannerisms. So I thought that was interesting as part of the, before the third act.
He just needs a costume, right? And she's a costume designer. Right. She's a fashion designer. She just does fashions for superheroes.
And I took it as he wouldn't have been able to go to the island and infiltrate and do everything he did without her help, or without having a suit made for him,
Yeah, I just thought she was an amusing character, and she is genuinely hilarious, and one of a lot of people's favorite characters in it. But yeah, she's not supposed to be Ayn Rand, and there's nothing Ayn Randian about this. It's more Nietzschean than Randian, because Nietzsche emphasizes blood and heredity as the basis of human excellence and human distinction.
I also like the end of the film, which you didn't touch on, although you touched on the conversation they have early on in the film, where Dash, the young boy, has to hide his power level, and he's not allowed to run in the race because it's too obvious. When he wins, he's too fast. He's so much faster than everyone else. Yeah. His name's Dash. He can run incredibly fast. And his mum says, you know, you can't rise up like this. You have to stay the same as everyone else. And he says, that doesn't make sense. You know, I've got this gift, everything else. And then at the end of the film, they play it off as a joke where he's running in the school race and he's running too fast. And they say, no, slow down. No, speed up. You know, don't win. Just come second, maybe.
Yeah.
That's touched to end the film on.
Yeah.
But I thought that spoke to the fact that society had brought these people low, these incredible people, and this incredible bloodline. They had reduced them to mediocrity, and they'd including this boy. Mm-hmm. I know it's kind of truncated, but the conversation he has with Helen that you actually write about in the review is it's almost like a political essay in a very bite-sized form, you know.
Yeah, the father is also objects to how, you know, the schools are celebrating mediocrity.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I love that. So, yeah, it's a very good anti-liberal, anti-egalitarian message put out by Pixar and Disney, surprisingly. And it got a lot of pushback from leftist types. They didn't like it. And it took years before Brad Bird? Was he the director of it? Did a follow up, and sadly, it just didn't measure up to the original. And you could see that he was being pressured to make it a little more politically correct.
Well, I took your advice and I skipped the second one, so I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
Okay, good. Well, I appreciate that. I like having an influence with these reviews.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm happy to leave it there if someone else wants to talk about one of the other films or add.
Yeah, Bill, I can't comment on The Incredibles, but I was going to throw it over to you, Bill. Do you have anything to say on The Incredibles, or do you want to talk about your favourite review in the book?
Yeah, I'll just say I have seen The Incredibles. I've got grandchildren now, so it's one of those inevitable things where you get to see these things, and I did enjoy it. But the film that really gripped me to read about from Greg's point of view was Lawrence of Arabia.
I'm glad you like that, because that is my absolute favorite film.
It's an incredible film. And I think the thing that really, really glowed for me in the text was that the reviews are peppered with analysis of film techniques, things that are often overlooked by the average reader, the viewer. I'm going to quote from, if you don't mind, I'm going to quote from the text where you say, this one scene, and I think this is beautifully put, because it really highlights the art of the filmmaker, where you say the juxtaposition of the three-dimensional Lawrence and the two, and this is when Lawrence is standing on top of a train, and the two-dimensional shadow and silhouette, along with the journalist's camera, is a subtle commentary on myth-making. Lawrence is becoming one of the shadows projected onto the walls of the cave of public opinion. And I think that nails it absolutely, because that sort of exploration of the character of Lawrence through a visual form is so beautifully conceived in at that point. And I think you nailed it there absolutely beautifully. I think Lawrence of Arabia is just such a magnificent film. And
Well, I'm very flattered that you picked that because Lawrence of Arabia is my favorite film. I would argue that it's the greatest film ever made, and I would argue for hours tirelessly if people wanted to argue about it. But I think David Lean, an English director, one of the great English directors, I think the greatest English director, was one of the great artists of the cinema. And I also review two other films by him in this book, Dr. Zhivago and Bridge on the River Kwai. Dr. Zhivago, Bridge on the River Kwai, and Lawrence of Arabia are all three in my top 10 favorite films. So Lawrence is my very favorite. And I think the script of Lawrence of Arabia is one of the greatest scripts ever created. It's incredibly beautiful as a literary production. It goes through the vastness of Seven Pillars of Wisdom and other literature about Lawrence. and distills out a story. It's still nearly 4 hours long, but it really distills the essentials. And where he has to drop certain characters or amalgamate characters just for economy, he does so in ways, it's Robert Bolt who's the principal screenwriter. Bolt does so in ways that heighten the dramatic quality of the film. So it's truly amazing. And it has very many memorable performances. Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence is absolutely wonderful. Anthony Quinn as Auda Abu Ta'i is absolutely unforgettable. And even in minor roles, they have fabulous characters. Jack Hawkins as General Allenby, I think, is absolutely fantastic. He was a great actor, and this is his best role. Being an Anglophile, this movie was just like catnip to me because the First World War for me is even more emotional and sad than the Second World War, and it was such a disaster. And yet there were a few bright spots in it, and one of the bright spots was this campaign in the Middle East when the British took Jerusalem for the first time in what, close to 1,000 years. That was kind of an amazing event in time. The rolling back of the Ottoman Empire, which certainly could be described as one of the more evil empires in human history, was great progress, I thought. And Allenby as a historical character, as well as Lawrence, is a thoroughly admirable figure, one of the great generals of the 20th century. And so seeing these people brought to life was truly moving for me. And another thing that Bolt does is he carries on an element of self-mythologization and self-apotheosis that you find in Lawrence's writing. And he does it very systematically. There's a clearly systematic repudiation of the Abrahamic religions that's going on by Lawrence's acts. And also there's a kind of self-apotheosis until he finally has his tragic fall from grace in the second part. And then he just decides that he's a spent force, and he goes back to England. So I think it's a truly great film, and I want everybody to see it. If you haven't seen it, it's really worth getting a few friends together, getting a really good version of it, getting a good screen to watch it on. You watch the first part, maybe have dinner together, discuss it, and then watch the second part, which is about 90 minutes long. It's film is high art.
Funnily enough, I actually watched the film because of the review. I hadn't seen any of the three films you mentioned there, but I read the review, so I went and watched Lawrence of Arabia, and it didn't quite catch me as much as it seems to have struck you. But I did think it was interesting the way that Lawrence is this kind of outcast. Kind of. You mentioned he was probably homosexual. I think he was slightly autistic. And I think Peter O'Toole kind of plays that in the film. But the fact that the British Empire had such a strong like moral cause or self-belief or story to tell itself, that it could use someone like Lawrence of Arabia for its own ends and give them such a mission that he would fulfill. And there are other people like that who have been kind of lifted up by the, I don't know, the former greatness of the British Empire, someone like Ernest Shackleton, maybe, or maybe not quite like that, but do you see what I mean?
So, that's one of the themes that I discuss in there is he's an outsider who becomes an insider, and that's really the plot arch of the first half of the movie. And I found that incredibly moving, how he he was this oddball, interesting, knowledge of you. There's a scene where Allenby's reading through his file and then the monocle drops from his eyes and he says, "There's no question, you're an interesting man." And he was a very knowledgeable man. And he was also a man of action, a real adventurer, still quite young. And he didn't quite fit in. And they found a way of using him that actually helped make history. And I think that that's sort of indicative of how great empires or any great enterprise can go forward is they find ways of using human talent, even odd human talent in this case. And so I thought that was a nice theme of the film. Another thing that I really loved about the film is that there's a conflict between empire and nationalism in it. And even though Lawrence is working for the British Empire, he wants to foster Arab nationalism. Whereas David Lean's opinion on this question, I think is really communicated simply by the way that he shows the British Empire to be extremely glamorous. And he does aestheticize and glamorize the empire quite remarkably. I just never thought the British Empire looked so good as in this film. He also does a similar job with the Bridge on the River Kwai, but it's not quite on the same grand scale.
And Allenby by Jack Hawkins there, I mean, he was superbly played. But I remember, I've seen this film, I saw this film when I was a child for the first time. And the scene that stuck in my head then was Lawrence with the candle when he says, the trick is not to mind that it hurts.
Yeah.
And then, of course, later on, when I viewed it again, the depth of the character development, I mean, it's just superb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a truly great work of art, and it's an indication of just how great film can be as a genre. And it's free of any enemy propaganda. And it intimates a couple of little red pills in the last half when this American journalist shows up. And it turns out that there is some shadowy group of people in the United States that are trying to use Lawrence of Arabia as a way of romanticizing this war because they want to get the United States involved in it. Well, we who know the background of the Balfour Declaration and all that, that's a little nod in that direction. That's part of the backstory here, which I think is
one of the other interesting things is that you talk about in the review about the mythologizing of Lawrence of Arabia. And in the film, it's played off as he's becoming mythic and legendary to the Arabs he's leading. Now, I don't know about that, but it's more that he's become a legend over here. And in fact, when I was still in the army, I did my tank training up at Bovington. And on the road circuit where you learn how to drive tanks on the road, you actually go past Lawrence of Arabia's house. And I'm pretty sure anyone who's learned to drive armored vehicles at Bovington will know where that house is and would have had it pointed out to them by, the instructors or the seniors as they've gone past, subsequent training cadres. So he's a legend to us, I think. I'm not sure if he still is in the eyes of the people who he helped fight against the Turks. I mean, maybe you know that, but I certainly don't.
Right? I don't really know what his status is there today. That's an interesting question. He certainly was a legend in his time, and he commanded a great deal of fanatical loyalty. And if you read Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is a long slog, it's more than 700 pages long, these men went through absolute hell with him. And he went through absolute hell to lead them and to fight this. And they genuinely admired him at the time. Now, it's sort of hard to be grateful to foreigners, though. And so I think over time, probably the memory of his role in the revolt against the Turks has probably been de-emphasized or forgotten in that part of the world because, He was an outsider, and so that's probably just the case. But I don't know, and I would be pleasantly surprised though if he still has a high reputation in the Arab world.
Well, you say that, Greg. I had a friend who was in Damascus about 7 or 8 years ago, and he said that when he visited Damascus, he was taken to the hotel where Lawrence had stayed. And there's pictures of him there, and they talk about, you know, L. Lawrence, and yeah. So they still.
Oh well, that's good. That's very good. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay, now it is my turn, and I'll start by saying I haven't seen Lawrence of Arabia, and I haven't seen The Incredibles. But after hearing about The Incredibles, that is something that I may well introduce my young daughter to, as it sounds like the kind of film I could introduce to her safely without there being any nasty messages or little hidden parts of the film which might upset myself and my sensibilities, because obviously I wish to protect her from any kind of moral filth. Now, my favourite book review of all the reviews that I read, of the films that I've seen and the reviews I read, was actually Greg's review of A Clockwork Orange. Now, if people who are watching tonight or listening tonight remember the film review that we did of A Clockwork Orange on our film club, you'll remember it ended in a little bit of an argument, because I didn't really like the film. I thought the film was very subversive. I thought the main character, Alex, was an absolutely thoroughly unlikable and vile human being. He's obviously a rapist, a murderer, a burglar, somebody who has no morality whatsoever, someone who thinks nothing of harming his parents, his friends, anybody really, for his own sick pleasures. And he goes throughout the film not learning a lesson, not redeeming himself. He has no character arc. But despite the fact that he is such a vile person who has committed these rapes and murders, the film absolutely glorifies him. He is the hero of the film. And by the end of the film, the filmmaker Stanley Kubrick has you rooting for Alex, has you on his side firmly. And he's not just the hero, but he's actually then made to be the victim. Not only are you rooting for this thoroughly awful human being, this creature, but by the end of it, you're feeling sorry for him, and you're actually clamoring for his rights, for his integrity, for him to defeat this system which he's trying to beat the brutality out of him and make him into a functioning human being, when in fact somebody who's a multiple rapist and murderer, the best thing for them would be just to be dragged out to the nearest piece of wasteland and to be shot twice in the back of the head. But this guy isn't shot, he's put into the correctional system, and he's allowed early release after undergoing a experimental procedure to make him into a better human being, so he can't indulge in these acts of violence and rape, and he can't be a menace to society. But on our film club, I said these things, and quite a lot of the audience, as well as people on the panel, didn't agree with me. They actually thought that Alex was somebody that we should have been rooting for, and people actually believe that he's kind of this anti-hero that we can in some way emphasize with. I don't. And when I saw that A Clockwork Orange was in this particular book, I was really, really interested to read what Greg thought about this. And thankfully, I'm not going to be arguing with Greg tonight, because myself and Greg see this pretty much the same way. And I actually said to Greg, there was only one small thing in the whole book that I disagreed with him on, but I really, really enjoyed the Clockwork Orange review, because I hadn't actually heard other nationalists see it in the same subversive and anti-white way that I did. And I spoke to him before the show and said, Greg, I was really impressed by this particular review. And Greg said he'd had a lot of pushback on this particular review. It's my favorite in the book. But Greg, tell us a little about your thoughts on Clockwork Orange, and then tell us about the pushback you had from other nationalists.
Well, I never wanted to review this because I didn't want to watch the movie again. And I remember seeing it years ago when I was a college undergraduate and just hating it. I just thought it was tasteless and dumb and overrated and just highly overacted. And so I didn't want to see it. I tried to approach it with an open mind. It had been more than 20 years since I'd seen it. And I saw it again, and I thought, no, I was right. This is not good. And I'm just going to read a couple passages here because I am kind of pleased with myself, I have to admit. This is from the last two paragraphs. But isn't Kubrick's treatment of this material brilliant? No, not really. Kubrick's treatment of sex and violence veers between the pornographic and the cartoonish. The entire movie is crude and cynical parody with an ugly cast, grotesque costumes, hideous sets, and dreadful overacting. The whole production reminded me of the comics of R. Crumb, who puts his prodigious talent to work churning out pornography, grotesquerie, and world-destroying cynicism. Crumb obviously hates America. He especially hates women. Likewise, the director of A Clockwork Orange obviously hates everything about Great Britain. He also takes particular pleasure in the mockery and degradation of women. Handling such material with technical skill does not redeem it. Indeed, by making it seductive, Kubrick actually makes it worse. A Clockwork Orange is violence porn and porn porn combined with a middlebrow moralistic message and some classical music. But these function merely as an alibi, like the interviews in Playboy. A Clockwork Orange is obscene in the literal sense of the word. It should not be watched. So I really don't like this film, as you can imagine. I give it -5 reviews. Now, I like some of Kubrick's other movies, but I really think this is a terrible film, and it annoys me when people praise it. It's like, are we on the same planet? Did we see the same movie? There's a message to it. Some people think, well, it's got an important message about human freedom. But I don't like the message about human freedom because the message about human freedom is this implicitly Christian idea that we've got free will. God gives us freedom to sin, and that's the most important thing about us. And there's nothing worse than operant conditioning that would take away a sociopath's desire to rape and kill because that takes away his freedom and his humanity. And I just say, bollocks, that's a false and destructive understanding of humanity. There's no virtue in having the freedom, the lack of character that would make it possible for you to weigh caressing or killing a person equally. You're equally free to do it at any of these things. And if a person is free in that sense, you'd call them sociopathic. You'd call them pathological. And to define humanity in terms of that kind of freedom and make that the message of this, I just think is a revolting message. And it is at the root of all this liberal rot about caressing criminals and not disciplining people too much, things like that. I just don't like that message at all. And that some people think it's deep is what, well, deep is a relative term. I don't think it's all that deep an idea. I think it's just a widespread and very bad idea that a lot of people hold to very dearly. So yeah, I really despise this film. I think it's the worst thing that Kubrick ever did. And I stand by that judgment.
I've got to agree. I think when I was an undergraduate, I was told time and again I had to see Clockwork Orange. This was this incredibly important film. And even in my 20s, when I saw it, I hated it. It just seemed to me vile. And seeing it, I've seen it twice, and twice is quite enough. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's, you said everything there, Greg, but yeah.
Do you know something else I really hated about A Clockwork Orange just before Natty jumps in? This is a really random thing. So I'm not opposed to watching sort of quite extreme violence if it has a place and a purpose. So, for example, in films like Scarface, where a guy gets chopped up with a chainsaw in a bathroom, that was actually based on a real life occurrence. And that's why it was actually allowed in the film. It was actually allowed in the film because, you know, they wanted to cut it out. The censors wanted that gone. They didn't want it in the film. But the director, Brian Del Palma, argued it had to be in the film because censors can't remove things from films in America if they're actually true to life. So they can take out things that are excessive gore in, say, a Friday the 13th film. But if something is actually a real life accurate retelling of something, then the censors cannot override that. And Brian De Palma actually got a police report and serving police officers to testify in front of the sort of board of censors that, you know, this had actually happened. And this was the kind of thing that was happening. These kind of horrific tortures were happening. And I found that really interesting. And I find that kind of violence in films sort of in a way necessary. It's horrific, but it's necessary because it tells a real story. But in this, the way that violence was dealt with, it seemed to absolutely glorify violence, but also sort of the silly noises, the costumes. It was kind of this sickening violence, but with a touch of Benny Hill. And I found that really off-putting, sort of some of the more outlandish and comedic parts of the film. I didn't enjoy that either. Natty, you unmuted. Go ahead, my friend.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised when I reached this part of the book because I started the book from the first page and was just going to read through it. And most of the reviews before The Clockwork Orange were actually fairly positive, although there was a few negative things said here and there. But I got to The Clockwork Orange and I thought, I haven't seen The Clockwork Orange. I watched it a long time ago. I only got halfway through the film, so let's see what Greg thinks. And then to read the review where you just pour scorn on the film, I was like, okay, yeah, I totally agree. I watched this film probably about 10 years ago and I couldn't even make it through the whole thing. I think I stopped just after where he is forced to watch the violence and has his eyes pinned back. But the film, apart from anything else, the themes or anything else, is just ugly. It's like repulsive to watch. It's like, I don't know, like sitting on grit or having grit in your hair or you know, that's just nasty feeling you get. It's really, really ugly and repulsive feeling you get when you watch it, like badly shot, like kind of low camera angles, and like you said, Mark, silly noises when there's violence going on, long shots that don't quite make sense. So I was totally not a fan. So to hear that everyone here is equally scathing of the film, I'm quite refreshed about it. I don't think I'm going to try and watch it again. I don't want to inflict that on myself. So yeah, I've agreed with everything you guys have said here. And the main character is repulsive. Anything I will say is that maybe it was a product of its time, and maybe that's the reason it gained such prominence or people like it so much. I mean, it was released in 1971, I think. So it could have been a...
I'll correct you there, Natty. People liked it so much, or it became a cult film, because at the time it was released, a lot of people who watched it and saw it at the cinema were sort of greatly titillated by it, and sort of young gangs started adopting the clothing and trying to act out parts of the film. And it caused a little bit of a moral outrage, which caused Kubrick to withdraw the film. So the film was no longer available in the UK, and it became this film that was effectively banned. Now, it wasn't banned. It was withdrawn by Kubrick, so it wasn't available in the UK, which gave it this incredible cult status of, have you seen A Clockwork Orange? Have you seen this incredible film? A bit like the Video Nasties, where these films like The Werewolf and the Yeti, which firstly isn't a great film, secondly isn't really even that gory, and thirdly would be forgotten to time had it not existed on a list of around 80 films which you know, constituted the video nasties, and that made it go down in infamy. So if you want to buy a VHS copy of The Werewolf and the Yeti, it'll set you back £200-300 even to this day because of that status.
Right, right. I wasn't aware of that. That does make sense, actually. So kind of Streisand effect where, you know, it's banned, it's forbidden, it's not quite right. Therefore, anyone who's against society or is a bit of a punk or a bit of an outsider or whatever, or feels that way, can go and watch it and imagine that they're gaining something from it.
Exactly.
I add to that, you know, the first time I saw it, I was a student in South Africa in the apartheid era. So it was banned in South Africa, and I saw it as a pirate copy. And that says everything you need to know already about the kind of, because the recommendations were coming from my teachers. So it tells you a lot about the kind of the teaching that was going on, the kind of things that were going on behind the scenes in South Africa at the time, and that cultural push to change things and to promote things like this.
Well, I will say one final thing about the film. I think, in a way, it is important, and I'll qualify that, because after all the bad things I've said about it, I think it is one of the most blatant attempts to do what the media often does, which is to paint somebody who is irredeemable as a man that needs saving or has worth or should be preserved by society. And I think that's something that the media does an awful lot. The media has this way, especially, you know, in this country. So I'll give you an example about this, dovetails with real life, and we'll go on to the next section of the show. Recently, we saw he's not African, he's of African descent, but he's Afro-Caribbean, and he was from the Caribbean, and he was a rapist. And he was meant to be deported from the UK, but due to the fact he was black and he was going to be deported, all these liberals on the plane jumped up and there were protests, and these people wouldn't let the plane take off. So the officers who were deporting him had to take him off the plane. And when they'd taken him off the plane, he was then allowed to stay in the UK, and liberals were sort of crowing as if like, oh, woo, isn't this wonderful? You know, isn't this absolutely incredible? The fact is, we saved this man from deportation, human rights. Isn't this great? This is the progressive world that we, you know, endeavor to live in. And this man then went on to kill somebody here in the UK after this failed deportation event. So if the liberals hadn't got their way, there wouldn't have been a death or a murder take place in Britain. The murder took place in Britain directly because of the actions of liberals. And I've always felt that films like A Clockwork Orange were used by the establishment to make normal people feel sorry for irredeemable people and to ascribe human rights to literally the scum of the earth. That's what the media does. And I think A Clockwork Orange is a perfect example of that kind of trickery. And I can imagine that there were people in Hollywood when this were made who were laughing, and they would be laughing because they would have looked at this film and said to themselves, we here have got a rapist, a murderer, a house burglar, probably, you know, other than being a paedophile, they're the three worst things you can be: a murderer, a rapist, and a house burglar. And we're going to make this murderer, rapist, and house burglar not only the hero, but we're going to have the audience sat cheering for his rights, for him to have the right to carry on doing those things. And when you look at that kind of message, it is absolutely, you know, it is absolutely sick, you know, sick in the highest. But that, unfortunately, is what has warped the minds of countless generations of white people. And as Bill said, you know, you can hear college professors, you know, telling the young people at their universities and colleges that this was a must-watch film that was absolutely, you know, had to be had to be viewed by any young progressive person who wanted an important moral message. Well, it's anything but an important moral message. It's pure weaponized filth. So yeah, that's my take on it. Now let's go on to the next part of the show. And I'm going to go around the group. We'll do the super chats in about 20 minutes, but we'll go around the group again, starting with you, Natty. Were there any takes that Greg had that you didn't agree with? So obviously Greg's reviewing these films, and I actually found Greg to be almost completely on the money here. And that's probably why I enjoyed reading it so much, because, you know, they were takes that I shared. And sometimes if you haven't formally sat down and reviewed a film, and somebody does review a film and you find their takes to be sort of the same as yours, you're like, oh, that's good. I picked that up too. Now, what do you think, Natty? Did you read any of this and think, oh, he's missed it there, or I don't agree with that bit?
Well, I read the book in chronological order, or as it was pen to paper, I read the Dune trailer review, not having seen the trailer for Dune, but just having seen the film itself. And I actually hated the film. I thought it was incredibly boring. And I read the book some time ago, so I couldn't really map it onto the book. To be honest, I know this is a big faux pas on the right, but I didn't even enjoy the book. I may have read it before I was kind of red-pilled, as it were, but I didn't enjoy the book, and I did not enjoy the film. I haven't seen the old wacky film. I can't remember the director now. Greg knows what I'm talking about, but the pace of it, the soundtrack, I really didn't like it, and the weird jarring end to it, which people have compared to the first Lord of Rings, where it kind of ends not really on what would typically be a storytelling ending. It kind of ends halfway through, but I think they're doing something similar with the Dune book, where they're doing half of it or one third of it. And Greg was fairly, I think, if I'm not misremembering this, was fairly glowing of the film, although he had some gripes with it too, including something that's just visceral, is making the Fremen at the end not just look kind of vaguely Arabic or Persian, but having like sub-Saharan Africans in there, which makes absolutely no sense, given that these were, you know, desert dwelling people based on people from the Persian Gulf or Egypt. So yeah, I'd be interesting to hear what Greg has to say about that. It may be that I just didn't enjoy it, because I don't really understand or get Dune and why it's so highly lauded.
Well, I think Dune is a masterpiece, really. The novel is a masterpiece. And it's a very reactionary work of fiction. So I was hoping that this would be well made, and I didn't really think it was a well-made film. I didn't like the race swapping stuff, of course, but that's sort of standard, and you can almost ignore that if the story is just well told. But I felt that it could have been so much better. I wanted it to be so much better. I would have forgiven the race swapping if they had made it more compelling, but it just sort of felt flabby to me. And I didn't think that it was aesthetically all that pleasing. And one of the things that's remarkable about this, I don't think I mentioned this in the review because I didn't know it when I wrote the review, but if you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, there are these scenes in the desert filmed in Jordan. And there's this one sequence in this place called Wadi Rum. And you have Audu Abu Tai say, I invite you to dine with me in Wadi Rum, you know, and then it cuts. And there's this absolutely spectacular landscape, these weathered rock outcrops and all these stunning colors. And there's this great sequence where all the tribesmen are mustering on their horses and camels and welcoming Auda to his camp. It's stunning. That was filmed in Wadi Rum. Okay, it turns out that some of the desert sequences in Dune were filmed in Wadi Rum. I'm sorry, but I did not see any of the stunning colors that were captured in Lean's film. I did not see the depth of focus. I did not see the delicate patterns of the sand that he would capture or anything like that. And I was really brought up short. I was astonished. Lawrence of Arabia was filmed. It was released in 1962. It was 60 years older than the Denis Villeneuve Dune film, and it didn't look as good when they filmed in the same places. The Lawrence of Arabia film was filmed in 70 millimeter, and it has amazing depth of focus and detail that not even these digitally filmed creations today seem to be able to capture. I found that kind of astonishing. So I was just disappointed with it. I didn't think it was horrible. I just thought it was disappointing, and it had just sort of fizzled. It fell flat, and it had offensive casting because basically what they were trying to do is take the Imperium in the Frank Herbert novel and turn all the bad guys into white people and all the good guys into a motley crew of whites and off-whites and people who look like Antifa. And I just thought that this in the age of Negro fatigue, this in the age of George Floyd was just too much. There are no characters that are described in the Dune book as black, as African, none whatsoever. There are some characters that are described as what you might say off-white or Near Eastern. There's one character who's described as perhaps having sort of Amerindian features, the swordmaster Duncan Idaho. But that's it. And to black up the character of Dr. Kynes and make him into a woman, I thought was ridiculous. To cast this Zendaya character, girl, as the love interest for the future emperor of the universe is racial cuckoldry. So I did not like this at all. It really bothered me. But I could have forgiven it if it was well done and conveyed the essence of the story.
In that case, I have to apologize to Mark because it turns out we don't disagree more than I thought, actually. Just before we move on, though, I will say you're absolutely right. I actually, when I read the book, I looked up pictures of Wadi Rum in Jordan, and it's stunning. And you would have thought that they would have tried to make Arrakis almost a character in itself.
Yeah, it is a character in the novel. It's a powerful character in the novel. And when I reviewed David Lynch's Dune, which you referred to, the goofy one, one of the things that I criticized most about it, and which I talk about in my review of the trailer, is that you don't get any of the beauty of the desert. Deserts are beautiful places, in my opinion. I love deserts. And I was thinking of David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia, that photography. There was absolutely nothing that approached that desert photography in Lynch's Dune. And I was hoping that Villeneuve would learn from that and really make the desert as beautiful and stunning as it actually can be. And instead, he filmed the desert as mostly just sort of sandy
just
and cloudy
background and scenery, like a low resolution CGI conception of what a desert is.
Exactly. So I was a little disappointed in that because he wasted an opportunity to make this movie a real feast for the eyes. And deserts well photographed can be real feasts for the eyes. Now, one of the things that I there are a couple things that sort of are like thematic clusters in this book. This is the first book where I review some classic Westerns, right? This book has a lot of stuff on great British filmmakers like Michael Powell and David Lean. I have a few David Lynch things in there too. One of the films that most influenced the Lawrence of Arabia filming stylistically was John Ford's The Searchers, which was shot in on location in deserts in the American Southwest. And again, with absolutely spectacular effects. And apparently Lean got a print of The Searchers and studied it very, very carefully to try and figure out how John Ford could capture this stunning, colorful desert landscape. And he did a very successful job of imitating that. But it's almost like a forgotten art. And this is something that's very disturbing. And it shows that we're not making progress on all fronts. Air travel today is slower and less comfortable than it was 50 years ago. Why? Because it's cheaper that way. Films are murkier and muddier and have worse depth of focus than they did 60 years ago when David Lean was filming in 70 millimeter. Why? Cost cutting. Cost cutting is an absolute bane of art. It's a bane of technology, of travel, and so forth. It's basically capitalism measures productivity in terms of costs per widget, right? And if you can get the costs down, you're more productive because you have more money to keep for your investors. And unfortunately, cost cutting has very negatively impacted filmmaking. Now, you'd think that it wouldn't because they're putting out $30 and $40 million films now, but they look worse than films that were done 60 years ago. Why? Because they're actually cutting costs in terms of the technology of filming, which is amazing and sad.
I didn't know that. And my only criticism, and it's not really a criticism. I've watched the new Dune, and I thought it was a little bit bloated. It ran on too far at the end. By the end, you could see the film becoming more and more anti-white. And you can see that these bald-headed barbarian whites known as the Harkonnen are going to be defeated, who are used by the intelligent whites, the Empire, you know, are going to be defeated by this multiracial ragtag bunch of people living in the desert who have all different races. So this rainbow alliance living in the desert are going to overcome them. But you said you didn't think the film was attractive. And I've got to say this, I watched the film and I was blown away by the direction and the art in the film. Now, I didn't really notice the deserts not being beautiful, but I did think it was a film that looked good. And I might be in the minority there, but that was the only thing in the book. I was like, you didn't think the film looked good, which I totally respect. I mean, that's a judgment call, and it doesn't detract from the incredible nature of the rest of the book. But that was the only thing in the whole book that I found myself disagreeing with you on. I did think the film looked gorgeous, and I did think it was sort of a good realization of this other world. I'm not going to go into this now. Maybe me and Natty will talk about this privately, but I do think Frank Herbert's book Dune, although it's meant to be this sort of, you know, seminal sci-fi epic, if the plot of the film is accurate to the plot of the book, I've got to say this, Herbert didn't actually have that great a plot on his hands, because I was watching it and just thinking to myself, if I was the emperor and I was worried about House Atreides getting too popular, why would I give them the most important job in the whole galaxy and put them on a pedestal? That will only make them more popular. And then to come up with a half-baked scheme of sabotaging them when they were doing the job and then murdering them when they didn't do the job perfectly after they were clearly sabotaged when being given the job. That's the most cack-handed plan anyone's ever come up with. And if you're like the emperor of the galaxy and that's your cack-handed plot, you absolutely do not deserve to be the emperor of anything, let alone the entire galaxy. But maybe that's for a separate review. So, Bill, very quickly, was there anything in the book you didn't agree with?
No, not really. I mean, the only thing I first of all was a little bit taken aback with was Greg's analysis of Conan the Barbarian, and that was purely because when I was in my 20s when I first saw Conan, it was a film that was inspiring to me as a young man. But I'm a Robert E. Howard fan, and I do have a problem with depictions of particular fictional characters which go so far from the actual source material. I had the same thing with, I know this is blasphemy, I realise, in these circles, but with the Lord of the Rings films, I've come to enjoy them very much. But there was, because they were an interpretation of the novel, there were certain elements of those particular interpretations that were problematic. And to be honest, reading Greg's review of Conan the Barbarian, I have to agree. I mean, Conan was a canny character in Robert E. Howard's Reckoning. And the Conan of the film version is rather a simpleton. The origin story is very different. So you almost have to view it as a kind of a separate entity. So, yeah, I kind of agree with it. But I do absolutely agree with your interpretation of Osric, but played by Fonsido.
Isn't he compelling?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And he just stands out. He just sort of class actor stands out in that role.
Yeah, and that's when it really made me realize this is being played ironically for laughs. Yeah. And it could have been such a good movie if they hadn't done that. Even with its departures from Holy Writ, right? Robert E. Howard. Yeah. If they had just played it straighter, it could have been a much more powerful film. I know why people liked it. I know why people liked it because it had things in there that were good. I just thought it could have been so much better. But here's the thing. People were starved for epic cinema when this came out. And they were willing to overlook its flaws because it was just so much better than a lot of the other stuff, the cops and robbers stuff or whatever that was coming out at the same time. This is a movie that had an epic orchestral score in the style of, you know, Miklos Rozsa or Maurice Jarre. That was a rare thing at the time. It really harkened back to an older form of filmmaking that I think is thoroughly admirable. I just didn't think it measured up. And it was being played ironically, which really irritated me. One of the revisionist things that that's sort of a theme in this is that John Milius, who's this supposedly based Jewish director and screenwriter, I really take to task. He has lots of fans on the right, but the work that he that I review in here is not good. He scripted one of the absolute worst of the sequels to Dirty Harry, for instance, and I was not crazy about what he did with Conan. It's played too ironically. Again, when there are two characters, one is the female thief, and the other is Osric, played by Max von Sydow, who sort of break out of playing it light and ironic for just a few moments, and they just blaze on screen. It's like I wish we could just get over this, and it is a very much a Jewish ironic style of filmmaking, even though people like Quentin Tarantino, of course, imitate that as well. But I really despise irony. When it's being used to basically diffuse great drama, pour cold water on great dramatic conflicts and themes.
Okay, well, look, it's getting to the last half hour of the show, so we've got some super chats.
Can I just jump in really quickly?
Sure.
I'll just say that for anyone who's watching this or listening to this, the film Conan, watching it now, is kind of cringy and it doesn't really do anything for me. But if you haven't read any of the books, I would say go and read them. There's a great collection. It's the Complete Chronicles of Conan or something.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah.
The writing in the Conan books is like, it's something else. It's like powerful, and it's totally based as well.
Yeah, it's sincere too. Robert E. Howard was sort of a skaldic figure. He would chant out these stories as he typed them. He was carried away in inspiration. I think they're wonderful. If you want a speech that is an introduction to Robert E. Howard, there's a wonderful speech by Jonathan Bowden praising Robert E. Howard. Yes. That I'd recommend too.
Yeah, and I will say, again, very quickly, I've just finished reading Bill's book that we may talk about before the end, and your fandom of Robert E. Howard stands out in the book, so it's quite clear it's an inspiration from the Conan stories from him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we should talk about getting your book reviewed at Countercurrents. So give me a message. We'll DM me on this and we'll try and set that up.
Thank you, Greg. I'll be delighted to.
Okay, let's do some of these super chats. We've got some over on Entropy. Some random bloke said, Greg, I read your reviews on uns.com. Can't watch movies again after being red-pilled. Thanks for shining a light on how anti-white Tarantino films are. P.S. He married a Jew and moved to Israel. Yeah, I hate Tarantino. Do you want to say anything quickly about how much you hate Tarantino, Greg? Because I'd love to hear how much you hate him, because I really despise him too.
Well, I haven't watched all of his films because some of them were so bad that I refused to see The Hateful Eight, for instance. I've reviewed a number of his films in the first Trevor Lynch film anthology. I have a 30-page review of Pulp Fiction. I think Pulp Fiction is an absolutely superb film that deals with deep philosophical themes and metapolitical themes. And so I go into it with maybe a nauseating detail, as some might say. But I think it's a great work. But I think it's almost accidentally great, because everything else he's done since then has been mediocre to absolutely terrible. And a lot of it's just evil, evil anti-white propaganda, pandering to the masters of Hollywood, the Harvey Weinsteins. Literally, Harvey Weinstein was one of his great patrons. He's really a schlockmeister who panders to evil. I read his book that came out recently on cinema, and I just thoroughly disappointed with it. It was just very, very padded, very pedestrian. I did think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was an okay film, but he hasn't done a really good movie. He's only done one really good movie, and I think that's Pulp Fiction, and most of his other stuff is terrible. My review of Kill Bill Volume 1 is one of the most I'll just crow about it. It's one of my more vicious, but I think insightful productions. And that's where I really take him to task for what I call Jewish cultural ironism. And you can find that review at Countercurrents. You just type in Kill Bill and it'll pop up.
Okay. I'm saying, before we move on to the next one, let me just say something about Tarantino. I very, very recently, in the last couple of nights, went back and to find a scene from Pulp Fiction, very famous scene, where Tarantino is actually starring in the film and he's talking about dead N-word storage. Yeah. And I thought it'd be quite funny. I keep hearing this in meme channels and on the right wing. So I went back and watched it, and it's terrible. And he's terrible in it. He's a really terrible actor. He overplays it. He keeps saying the word over and over again, like he's getting some weird pleasure from it. So I'm not a fan of Tarantino anyway, but I went back and watched that and I thought, Tarantino, he's a horrible man. He's not a very good actor either.
Yeah, he's the worst part in that movie. I wish he had not inserted himself into it.
Yeah.
Okay, some random bloke also said, hey, Greg and Mark, please watch a British 2014 film called Catch Me Daddy. It's a surprisingly honest look into Pakistani honor killings in Britain. Well, I've not even heard of that, but I'll look into it. Thank you. He also said, hey, Greg/Mark, with AI advancing at such a rapid pace, do you think this is an opportunity for dissidents to start making movies? Well, I'll say this. I think with AI advancing at the pace it is, and with CGI, you will start to see movies either being completely remade or being heavily, heavily touched up and utilizing, including with extra scenes, utilizing dead celebrities who have been recreated in CGI using artificial intelligence. And apparently this isn't just going to be affecting movies, but also computer games. I was reading the other day about a new AI system that if you feed in photographs into this system, it can generate, the more photographs and the more data you give it, it can generate fully 3D worlds based on your photographs, but based on these images. And obviously the more images you give it, the more realistic it will be, and the more workable it will be as a tangible 3D world. So I do think AI will totally change the way that we view films or the way media is created. What do you think to that, Greg? AI creating films?
Well, I think this is realizing one of Orwell's prophecies, where he talks in 1984 about propaganda films and songs and novels written by machines. I think we're now at the point where we might have artworks that are created entirely by machines. Here's the thing. It might be better than some of the crap that's being churned out by Hollywood today. So I just don't know. What I'm interested in is
that was
using
gonna be my point, actually, Greg. I was going to say it. AI can not possibly be worse than the repulsive Jewish propaganda we have to put up with now.
Yeah, of course, it's just another tool in the hands of these Jewish propagandists. But if you left it to its own devices, it would probably actually produce better work. Now, I do think it's very interesting that we might have the ability to ethnically cleanse some of these race swappings that have been foisted upon us. People can just go into, eventually somebody sitting at home with his laptop will be able to download a movie and go in and remove cornrow Liette Kynes from the new Dune movie and replace it with a Max von Sydow Liette Kynes or somebody more appropriate. And that can be done. That would be very, very interesting. As fast as they black up historical characters, we can undo it in our own remakes. I think that would be very, very interesting. And it's also a great leveler because movies cost tens of millions of dollars and are the products of enormous corporations with vast amounts of capital. And if we can not just review them in a way that reveals the propaganda, the regime propaganda, but also rework them to remove it, then and do it at very little expense compared to the original, that is a great form of asymmetric warfare that works in our benefit. So I'm kind of looking forward to those benefits from AI.
Okay, thank you very much. The next chat is from the same guy, and he says, "Hey, Mark, slightly different topic, but Ron Unz was recently on with Keith Woods. Although Ron is Jewish, he red-pilled me on the JQ. Read his American Pravada series. You should try and get him on PA. Well, I've never spoke to him, but I'd be happy to have him on. Cheesy, what's it go? £50. Thank you so much. Very generous of you. And he said, Greg's reviews in the book of the Powell and Pressburger films were really good, especially the corrective one on Blimp. I hope Greg considers writing more on them, especially their propaganda films. I think there would be a lot to criticize and uncover in films like The 49th Parallel or Canterbury Tale. I'm not familiar with that, Greg, but if you'd like to answer that, that'd be appreciated.
Yeah, I want to do more on Powell and Pressburger. I think The Red Shoes by Michael Powell is one of my favorite films. It's in my top five films. I love this film. I think it's absolutely brilliant. And another film that Powell directed called Black Narcissus, which I review in the volume as well, I think is another brilliant film. He directed about 30 films, though, and once I got through those two and started looking for others that were good, I started finding that they were increasingly few and far between. Very flawed productions, but one film of his that's massively, massively praised is the Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And I think it's an absolutely wretched and evil piece of propaganda, anti-German propaganda. It was done during the Second World War, and it's propaganda in favor of war crimes, committing war crimes against Germans. And it's despicable. It's a despicable, evil film. Unfortunately, or maybe I should say fortunately, it's such an inept, badly done film that it blunts the evil message. And so I thoroughly despise this film, and I pan it very carefully. Now, Powell did other propagandist films like A Canterbury Tale, there's one film that's absolutely bizarre called Stairway to Heaven, which is just filled. But again, it's clumsy. It's clumsy propaganda. A Canterbury Tale is actually a pretty good movie. 49th Parallel, again, a propaganda film, but it actually sort of works as a movie. I will write more about his work. His early work up to the Red Shoes, I think, is generally fairly sound. Then after that, the quality of it starts dropping off pretty dramatically, sad to say. But yeah, Powell was enormously talented. The trouble is that he was joined at the hip with this Hungarian Jewish film scriptwriter, Emmerich Pressburger, who fancied himself the Jewish Dr. Goebbels, but was nowhere near in Goebbels' league, although it's clear that he was definitely trying to put out propaganda. I think that everything that's great about Powell's films is the work of Powell, and practically everything terrible about him is the work of Pressburger. But some of Pressburger's scripts are pretty good, and those would be The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus. So those are my thoughts, but I'm glad you're interested in that. I think Michael Powell was a very talented man. Like David Lean, he worked his way up from the very bottom. He started out just doing gopher jobs in film studios and then worked his way up to being a director. That's a very interesting story that simply couldn't be repeated today, right? Film schools and credentialism and stuff like that. You just don't start out as a talented person at the bottom at the film studio and work your way up to the top of the system like these men were capable of doing. And that was a better system than the current system that we have today, because it brought fresh blood and fresh talent in. People would start at the very bottom, sweeping up, right, and work their way to the top. So thank you for that. That's a good question.
Well, thank you so much. Cat Hugger gave $5. Great to see you tonight, Cat Hugger. Not heard from you for a while. Lovely to have you back. And she said, most surprising modern right-wing movie, The Devil All the Time. A young white male hero kills a sexual degenerate and a paedophile child groomer with an old Nazi gun, a war trophy gift from his father, which he calls the best gift he has ever gotten. Worth a watch. Have a nice evening. I've not even heard of that film, but
I just
The Devil All the Time. So yeah, I'm going to check that
I've
one
seen
out.
That. Thank Come on, so on streaming services, actually. I've always skipped it because it just looked kind of like modern and trashy, but given that brief synopsis by Cat Hugger, I think I'm going to have to give it a try.
No, it does sound good. $10 came from Return to Chimp, and he said, thank you for this content, Mark. Well, thank you very much, my friend. $5 came from The Thin Red Line. Thank you very much. And he said, I like the movie. I don't see the protagonist as a hero. I see the entire movie as a warning on where society is going and why it is moving there. The horrible, brutalist architecture and general hedonism of our time. Well, thank you so much. He obviously likes the A Clockwork Orange. St. Harrison gave 5 Odyssey tokens. Thank you so much. He said, A Clockwork Orange is an awful film. Does Greg see the greatest film ever, A Towering Inferno, as a rejection of modernity and how progress isn't always for the best?
I confess I haven't seen The Towering Inferno. So I guess I can't really say that Lawrence of Arabia is the greatest film ever if I haven't seen The Towering Inferno and eliminated it from the running. But anyway, I haven't seen it, so I can't comment. Sorry.
I would disagree with you on that. I haven't seen Lawrence of Arabia, so it's probably unfair for me to disagree with you. But I feel The Godfather is the greatest. It's certainly the greatest film I've ever watched. You obviously didn't cover the Godfather in this book, but what's your take on The Godfather? Did you enjoy it or have you not seen it?
No, I've seen The Godfather. In fact, I recently watched it in the 4K Ultra HD edition that was brought out. And I think it's a very fine film. I think it's a highly accomplished piece of work. I also had a somewhat heretical take on The Godfather Part 3. I actually like it better than Part 2. In some ways, it's the most moving of the three movies for me. So I watched all three of them in rapid succession and studied them pretty carefully. And I do plan to write something on the series. I'm probably going to have to rewatch them now. But The Godfather is bravura filmmaking. It's truly extraordinary. It's a great story. I've just been rereading Machiavelli's The Prince for the nth time. And these people, these mafiosi, they behave like these Renaissance princes. It's just fascinating. What I loved about The Godfather Part 3 is that it explicitly brings out the paganism of the Italians, even to this day. There's a scene where this cardinal who becomes the Pope takes a rock out of a fountain and then cracks it open and says, it's wet on the outside, but it's dry on the inside. And he said, Europe has been bathed in Christianity for nearly 2,000 years, but it hasn't penetrated to the core. Well, what is in the core? Well, you see that in the film. And these people behave like pagan Romans, basically. The way they dress, the way they behave, the opera staged, et cetera, it's all pagan, it's all Roman. They never went away. And I love that about the film. So I'm going to write a piece, a fairly substantial essay about the three Godfather films this year.
Okay, that sounds very interesting, and it's something I will definitely enjoy reading. Reed Johnson gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, thank you both for a highly elucidating show. Much appreciated. Thank you very much. Thin Red Line gave $3 and said, I would like a review of Lars von Trier's Europa. He is obviously not one of our guys, but I think he's quite sympathetic to the Germans in this movie. Well, I haven't watched that particular film, so I can't give an opinion on it. Have you seen Europa, Greg?
Lars von Trier. No, I haven't. That's one of his films that I haven't seen. It is reviewed at Countercurrents. I think John Morgan reviewed it at Countercurrents, if you want to take on it.
Okay, and finally, Black Pigeon Pilled gave 0.01 of a penny. Thank you so much. And he said, what does the panel think of The Outlaw Josie Wales? I ask as it started as a novel which Clint Eastwood paid out of his own pocket to bring to the big screen. Thank you for the stream, lads. I really like Clint Eastwood films, and I like Clint Eastwood films where Clint Eastwood plays a role in production or direction, but I haven't seen The Outlaw Josie Wales. And if you asked me about a Clint Eastwood film, a Western, my favorite Clint Eastwood Westerns are not actually The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I really like Unforgiven, and I also like Pale Rider. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is an amazing film, but I really, really have fond memories of watching Pale Rider and Unforgiven. What do you think to that, Greg? Have you seen The Outlaw Josie Wales?
I have not. That is on my list of Westerns that I want to watch and maybe review. I do like a lot of Clint Eastwood's films. I do think that his Sergio Leone trilogy are absolutely fantastic, compelling films. I really love those movies. I love Leone's direction. I love Ennio Morricone's music. It's great cinema. And I'd like to write something about those films too, but there's really not a lot to them that I can analyze discursively. They don't have much in the way of scripts and things like that. They just have amazing style and atmosphere. And I absolutely love those films. So yeah, I want to write more about Westerns. And this volume contains reviews of three Westerns. There's The Searchers, The Man Who Killed Liberty Valance, and also Red River. I think all of these are epic films. I absolutely love those films. And they're serious films. They deal with serious, deep issues. I think the Western genre is one of the greatest things about American filmmaking, and it's one of the most reactionary, generally, in American film. And it's one of the most white. It's one of the most Faustian. You know, it's one of the most heroic. And so I want to write more definitely about Westerns, because a lot of them are surprisingly deep movies too.
Okay, thank you. Well, that about brings us to the end of tonight's show. However, it's not over yet, because everyone's got to give their final thoughts on this incredible book. Obviously, I'm being a bit biased there. You know what my thoughts are going to be. We'll start with you, Natty, then we'll go to you, Bill, then I'll give my thoughts, then Greg can have the final word, and then I'll tell you all about who's on PWR next week. Take it away, Natty.
When I was growing up, my parents used to read The Guardian, so we used to get the TV guide, and there would be tiny one paragraph film reviews in the guide. I used to love reading when I was small. I started reading at a very, very young age. And the reviews in this book have kind of reignited my love for that kind of very short form, although this is obviously, these reviews are longer than one paragraph, very cutting, very insightful, very well-written and well-edited reviews of short reviews of films that I think there's a lot to be taken away from. So definitely recommend, definitely one to have around the house, and I'll definitely be reading more from Leon's review, and I've actually got it bookmarked now, so I'll be looking for more of the reviews and searching up films that I may have seen in the past that I haven't realized some of the films in or haven't quite understood. So yeah, definitely a good read.
Well, the best place to follow my film reviews is at Countercurrents, because I'm not writing for the Uns Review anymore. I wrote for them for 2 years, and I stopped doing it because I didn't want to produce on a regular schedule, because I wanted to focus on this book, on The Great Replacement. I am back to writing film reviews, but they're just going up primarily at Countercurrents. And so I've done a few recently. I did a review of Tar, the Todd Fields movie. I did a review of the two versions of Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile that were released in theaters. And I also did a double review of Bullet Train and Babylon back in, I think, January, because, well, they didn't, I couldn't say enough to do whole reviews on them. But they sort of fit together into one piece. And so, yeah, those are recent. Those are the most recent publications.
Okay, thank you. I saw Bullet Train as well. I really enjoyed that. Bill Aethling, your final thoughts on the book, my friend?
I think this is a book that would be a useful addition to any film school library if it were allowed entry. But more importantly than that, it's a non-fiction page-turner. Anyone interested in visual and popular culture would enjoy reading this book. What's more, the text transcends the functionality of a simple reflection on the movie-making process. An example of this is Lynch or Greg discussing Dr. Zhivago, where he provides a damning and irrefutable condemnation of communism And then I think it was on page 124. He's spot on liberalism. I'd love to quote the whole thing. It's a whole paragraph there, but I won't because I know time's pressing. But yeah, highly recommend. It's a great book.
Okay, my thoughts are, I really love this book. It's easy to digest. It's very easy to get into. You don't have to read it all in order. You can pick and choose. It's a book where I agreed with almost every aspect of what was written in it. I really like the takes on these films. I think you would too. And I also think it's a good book because if you haven't seen all the films, there are also some great suggestions in there. And you can watch the film and then read Greg's take on the film. So definitely a book to recommend to anyone. Greg, would you like to have the final say? And then I will give an update on what I'm up to next week.
Well, first of all, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate being appreciated. I like it when people like my work. I like hearing from people who like my work. If you like this book, there are four earlier volumes of Trevor Lynch film reviews for you to dig into. And I recommend those. I highly recommend them. I love watching films. I like writing about films. And I love it when people share my enthusiasm. So that's very touching to me. And it means a lot. I really enjoy this, just hearing from you guys. I am going to continue to write on film. And I look forward to volume 6. As soon as volume 6 comes out, I'll pop it in the mail to you. It'll probably be 2 years or so before I get around to it. But some of the things I'm going to be working on for that, like I said, I'm going to be writing on the Godfather trilogy. I also have plans to write a lot more on Westerns. I want to write a lot more on Akira Kurosawa. And I want to write about some of Fellini's classic films. Some of his work is absolutely top notch. He's one of the great filmmakers. Some of his movies are so powerful that I've only been able to watch them once. La Strada is a film that I've only been able to watch once, and I'm going to have to force myself with those clips, like in the Ludovico machine, to keep my eyes open to watch this film because it's so utterly heartbreaking. So yeah, I've got a lot to I've got a lot of great films to write about, and I'm looking forward to doing it and sharing it. And feedback like this just encourages me more.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'm pleased we've managed to provide you with some encouragement because it's a book we all enjoyed. Now, I'm just going to finish things off by telling you a bit about what I'm going to be up to next week. Now, next week, PWR is on at the usual time, and we've got Jared Taylor on, so that is going to be one to look forward to. He unfortunately missed out on the 200th episode, and that was due to a bit of a communications issue, so he's making it up to me by jumping in for a solo show with me next week. So make sure you've got that one in the diary. We've also got the PA monthly update on next Friday, and on Tuesday, this isn't going to be one of my streams, but Joe Marsh is doing a special Welsh nationalist stream on the protest that was held yesterday in Llantwit about the migrants being housed there. And tomorrow night, Sam and Laura will be back for Tea Time with Sam and Laura. So plenty to sink your teeth into next week. So I'd just like to thank everybody. I'd like to thank Natty and newcomer Bill. I'd also like to thank Greg for not only being here, but also for writing such an excellent book. And I'd like to thank everyone who donated so generously. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And finally, thank you to everyone who tuned in. I always enjoy these book reviews, and I also enjoy film reviews. So sort of combining the two for tonight's chat was a little bit irregular, but I think it worked really well, and I really enjoyed it. And to be honest, knowing that Greg has written several of these other books on films, it makes me want to get them all and just do this every month, because I really enjoy this. And also, maybe we'll have Greg on our film club one month if we're doing a film. Maybe if we review Lawrence of Arabia.
I'd love to.
I would definitely bring Greg on for that, because that's a film we haven't reviewed. And I always enjoy working with Greg. As I've said to you all before, met him several times. He's really nice in person. one of the hardest workers and most influential people in this movement. So please do support him and his excellent work over at Countercurrents. That brings us to an end to tonight's show. Thank you so much. I love you all. And I'll see you same time next month for another book review. And I'll see you plenty of times before then for the great shows and different output that we all produce week in, week out. Thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend, what's left of it. Good night, everyone. And see you all again soon.